Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 LPFM, Lexington, Kentucky. Here on beautiful Lexington Community Radio, I'm Chuck.
I'm Ben.
And we'll be with you until 2 o'clock. Joining us here in the second hour, where do I begin?
Our original host. Back when this was interview radio.
The creator of WRFL. The creator of this very show, Bluegrass Bios, and so many other things.
Co-creator, Chuck.
Co-creator. Ben has been here from day one. Kyle, also Lexington Sours.
You know,
we have a varied and incredible cast, including me, Khaki Urch. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Khaki.
Nice to be here on Bluegrass Bios with you and Chuck.
Well, if we do anything right on this show, it's because of Khaki.
And if
we do anything wrong, it's because we didn't listen to her when she was here.
Yeah,
man, you said it.
Radio is a difficult medium because you can't really see me twisting my face up like you guys. but I am glad to be here and to talk about anything you guys want to throw out. And I've brought my friend and intern, Gabby Rogers, here. So she's going to be here with me for a couple of minutes because it's intern time. Hi, Gabby.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Gabby. Thanks for coming in. Awesome. So Khaki, professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Kentucky, or they call it something else now, right? It's not just the School of Journalism.
No, it's called, I'm an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Media, so sometimes we call it the UK Jam School.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Jam session.
And you can actually follow that if you're interested at UK Jam School on Twitter, and we are on the Facebook as well as School of Journalism and Media at University of Kentucky. We're part of the College of Communication and Information, which includes a Department of Communication, and it includes a Department of Integrated Strategic Communication. It includes ICT, which is Information Communication Technology, and it includes Information Studies, which used to be Library Science.
Wow.
So we've got a lot
of... Yeah, that's what it was in my day.
Yeah, we've got a lot of some of the most interesting thinkers and writers and teachers on the campus in our college, and I'm happy to be part of it. My role is to teach in the School of Journalism and Media, in the School of Journalism itself, multimedia. So I teach web design and publishing, radio, video, writing, of course. I'm, you know, a certified journalist, worked as a professional journalist for a long time. So, and we don't actually certify journalists in this country, which is important to know. We do not license journalism in this country. And so if anyone proposes that, right? But, yeah, and so that's what I do for a job these days.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, awesome. Well, certainly journalism is in a funny place right now in the United States.
Well, right. I mean, people are questioning, you know, the word of the year by the Oxford English Dictionary has been chosen as what, post truth.
Mm.
So,
wow.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
It was up against woke. It was up against woke and one.
Aren't
other.
Those synonymous? I mean,
Chuck's not woke.
He doesn't know the difference between those.
Yeah,
it was a joke.
It was chosen to be post truth. And so what we have is we have the cadre of the establishment journalism or mainstream media, which I certainly train people to be part of, questioning themselves on how well they understood audiences, how well they understood, I think, what we might call leakage of audience.
Mm.
And, you know, we have this because of social media. We have the ability for anybody to be a true kind of mass media, and because of social media and the internet. And we also have somewhat the removal of the designated middleman in terms of, we see this with President-elect Trump sort of trying to elide or evade or eliminate the press corps or the pool which follows the president and which has followed the president since a long time. So, but I think it's an exciting time. The New York Times itself has seen an increase of 40,000 subscriptions just since the election.
40,000.
40,000, because people are saying, well, if we were not plugged in to what was happening, if we were surprised at who the candidates were, what the outcomes were, who the audiences were, then let's go and find some journalism that we do sort of trust to be factual. The Washington Post has had an amazing surge in readership and in subscribership. It is now owned, of course, by the head of Amazon, mm-hmm. right? And they have made, interestingly, if you are listening and you are a person who has an email that ends in .gov, .edu, or
mm-hmm. probably .org in there.
.org, but mm-hmm. in any case, for governmental and educational people,
they are offering .us, I think. Or maybe just here.
Well, .us would be part of .gov, mm-hmm. so yeah. The Washington Post is offering free digital subscriptions.
Oh, wow.
So if you go to their website, you can...
So if you're a student or, mm-hmm. or a teacher
a government employee, cool. which I believe also is going to include a service member, right? I think mm-hmm. that service mm-hmm. member is...
Probably .mil in there somewhere.
Yeah. So in any case, we are in an interesting place.
Do you think people are now realizing you can't believe anything you see on Facebook just because it's a Facebook post? As I think we're getting stories now about how all this stuff sort of permeated under the surface,
right.
well, and went completely unchecked.
What could surprise me, if I were surprisable anymore, which I'm not, but what could surprise me was that they didn't approach Facebook that way previously. You know, Facebook has a headline on a piece, mm-hmm. and then underneath there's a source for where it is. And, you know, I made this up in macedonia.news.com, or something that you don't recognize as a really strong fact-based source is something that I would always not look at. And you know, that's part.
I think on the phone app you can't see it on the phone.
Oh, interesting, interesting.
I don't think I ever see. I don't ever see. I see who it came from.
Right. So, I mean, as a journalist, as a journalist, and you know, as a person who's a part of several different communities that are, you know, needing to be critical and skeptical, I've been raised to say, "Says who." Right. So I always approach my Facebook says who, and I don't share something unless I see says who and whatever. Right. But obviously, if you've got something in a font and you've written it in headline style and you've got that rhetorical presentation that looks like news reporting, but you're putting in things like it did come on my Facebook feed with Pope Francis. Francis endorses Donald Trump.
Mm.
Right? This is one of the fake Facebook news feeds that was made up by these guys in Macedonia. There were people in Macedonia who were planting fake Facebook. But I'm not sure that we can blame the outcome of
putting the election aside, now we're seeing
Facebook.
What percentage of adults are now getting all of their news from Facebook
right.
or Twitter?
Well, here's
and
the
not
thing.
A quote-unquote legitimate news source.
Here's the thing. You know, I am a journalism educator, and we do train journalists, and we do train them to do Facebook Live. We do train mm-hmm. them to, you know, post to social first, think social first, and then later are these more... static or standing things like a press start where you make a printed paper, you know, or a broadcast where people sit down in the 1950s at 5 o'clock. Who's at home at 5 o'clock? you know, and watch the news. And that's why we've seen broadcast news span from... It seems like that whole 2 hours, you can see the news because broadcast knows it needs to expand its watch time. But also broadcast and networks of cable or, you know, cable sports. I have a lot of students who work at ESPN on their social.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody sees the 24-hour cycle. Everybody sees the social first element. It's just some people are approaching that extraordinary power that's available to anybody.
I don't think most people are doing that. I don't think they're consciously subscribing to ESPN or the Washington Post. What they mean by getting their news is my aunt posted something to Facebook.
Right, right. Okay, well what, and it's only been in the last 5 or 6 years that, quote, you know, mainstream media has really made the effort on Facebook. But you can go, and you can go to your local newspaper. So in our city, it's the Herald Leader. Mm-hmm. They do Facebook feeds, and they keep their news very up to date on that. You can go to the Washington Post. You can go and follow them, like them on their Facebook page, and then they come into your feed. So you don't have to wait for the newspaper to be delivered or for your aunt to decide what she thinks is true.
Right.
But
I do think it's important to recognize that there's a lot of good, credible news that is being shared on social media that people wouldn't otherwise be, you know, see. I think about, like, you know, Sean King or folks that were citizen journalists who, you know, started just sharing stories, and people realized that what they were saying was credible, and then they built a following. And so even, Kaki, I know you were brought on to be the Twitter professor at UK.
Well, right. That's a line I say. Yeah. I mean, okay, first of all, we don't have a Twitter professor, because I think that somebody would have a problem with that. But
of course.
When you do interview to be a professor, you do a job talk, you do a presentation of your research and interest and whatever to your colleagues. And I came to be to fill a role that was, you know, multimedia oriented, and this was in 2008. And so in 2008, I came and I gave a talk about, you know, I'm like, well, I could talk to you about blogs, and they're like, oh yeah, yeah. And I'm like, that is so over. It's all about this. And I, you know, put up a cell phone and Twitter, which was not heard of, and which was you know, in many ways mocked. I mean, I had one student where I taught about Twitter, and I was completely mocked in the classroom to teach him about it and whatever. And then, yeah, sure enough, he goes out to Silicon Valley, gets a job at Twitter.
Whoops.
Whoops.
Jokes on that.
Right. So, and he also worked at Pinterest, too. So, but...
I guess the reason...
A major... I teach students how to use Twitter as a fact finder, as a source finder.
Mm. In sort of a Wikipedia way, is sort of like, this is a good starting point. It's an
right, right. It's a good starting point. And there are many, many legitimate people who are putting out information that is true, that is balanced, that comes directly from the source that you can follow on Twitter. I mean, you don't just have to follow your friend, you know, who is writing about who or who didn't, you know, have fun last night. Have fun.
Yeah.
Right. But, like, you can follow the Smithsonian, and you can follow all elements of the National Endowment for the Humanities. A whole bunch of our great nonprofits have Twitter feeds, and, you know, things like foreign policy, the big foreign policy, like, expensive, you know, journal. I don't know. It costs $300 a year. Mm-hmm. They're on Twitter. They're putting things out on Twitter. The Economist.
Yeah,
is putting things out on Twitter. And not only that, you can listen to a lot of different voices if you follow people from other parts of the world. I have whole sections of my Twitter that comes. They get, quote, turned on earlier and later because they're in Britain, because they're in Ireland, because they're in Africa. And you can see what other people are thinking. And then the other thing is, you know, I'm a white guy. So I've made it a goal of mine to make sure that 51% of my follows, who I follow on Twitter, are African-American women. So, but you can, you know, Black Twitter, which has been such a moving force in things, take a listen to Black Twitter. Follow a whole bunch of African American folks and see what Black Twitter has to say on that, or click on a Black Twitter hashtag. There's all sorts of ways, and I think that the mainstream media, even though they may be using Twitter and Facebook as a push platform, are not doing maybe the important listening that they need to, because they were surprised that, you know, 26% of the Black vote didn't turn out because Hillary Clinton was not Barack Obama.
Well, and also, I think the crime bill still has some lasting implications.
Sure,
well, that's another. That's
a whole the crime bill, but this, the surprise of these guys who were, you know, and the other thing is, one of the things we have as a press, by the way, what are we listening to here? Mm-hmm. Bluegrass Bios?
Bluegrass Bios.
Yes. Bluegrass Bios? Yeah. Who am I?
Yeah, this is Khaki Eric, Professor Khaki Eric. I guess the reason, Khaki, I asked you that question is because I do think that Twitter makes information more democratic and more digestible because of the limitations of, mm-hmm. of how much you can write about it. I guess it was kind of a lead-in. I wanted to ask you, kind of, since you gave that lecture when you came to UK to now in this election, how have you seen the role of Twitter and social media? I mean, besides literally starting revolutions in Egypt and
Libya,
how have you seen it change and kind of develop, maybe particularly over this election period?
Well, I think that your moment of the Asian Spring, not the Asian Spring, I'm sorry.
The Arab Spring,
where one man in particular at NPR, the multimedia guy at NPR, became sort of the U.S. translator for everyone who was posting from whether it was Egypt or Tunisia or these different places where unrest and then the fall of governments was happening. But, you know, one other watershed moment, it was the death of Michael Jackson.
Mm.
Okay, because Twitter, in the form of what is that show? The guy in Hollywood sits around. It's a paparazzi show.
Oh, like TMZ?
TMZ, yeah. Oh, okay. Which stands for 30 Mile Zone. You know that, right?
Did not know that.
Okay, there's a 30 Mile Zone from one particular corner in Hollywood that is the Union Zone. So if you're a Union Hollywood worker in that 30 Mile Zone, then you get one rate, but if you go out outside of the TMZ, the rate goes up. And then there's a 90 Mile Zone,
did
too.
Did not know that.
So yeah, so when they wanted to name themselves a Hollywood insider thing, they named themselves TMZ, 30 Mile Zone. Okay, so TMZ beat every other media, including the Associated Press, which prides itself on being the first legitimate teller of fact in America. And if you beat AP, it used to be in my day, if you beat AP, you were really fast. Now AP is really, really late all the time because they have very high standards for veracity and truth.
Yeah.
And because of that, TMZ beat AP for about 2 hours with the information that turned out to be true of the death of Michael Jackson.
Wow.
And so people turned to the social media for this incredible experience. And I think another watershed social media moment was, in fact, the inauguration of Barack Obama, where some of the TV outlets, including CNN, hooked up with Facebook and Twitter and put some of that social on the air. It's completely the 24-hour cycle was created by CNN, right, and ESPN, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then we're beyond a 24-hour cycle. I mean, we are at a 60-minute cycle, you know. So, and Twitter is a 60-minute, 140-character cycle.
Yeah, right. Right.
So,
yeah, well, it's pretty fascinating that just not only nationally, but internationally, too, you know, journalism and media and social media is really in kind of unprecedented territory. And I guess that's just a lead into my next question to you. As a professor at the University of Kentucky and kind of hearing about the Colonel controversy and kind of student journalists, you know.
Should we background that controversy so people know what it is?
Sure.
Yeah, I could use a little refresher.
Okay.
Personally.
At this moment, the University of Kentucky is suing the Kentucky Colonel, which is the independent student newspaper that is a longtime part of the University of Kentucky student organizations. I am an alum of that newspaper, as are many professional journalists in the state. And it is a pacemaker winning, won the pacemaker, which is the Pulitzer for college newspapers this year. It's complex. The university is suing the Colonel not because they don't like the Colonel, but because they don't like a ruling by the Attorney General. The Colonel submitted Freedom of Information Act requests for documents about an investigation into a sexual harassment, sexual assault claim at the EEO office by some graduate students, former graduate students, against a professor who was later allowed to resign. And the university says that those records are protected by FERPA, which is a Federal Education Records Protection Act, formerly known as the Buckley Act, and does not want to release them because it has said several times that the privacy and confidentiality, which are two different things, of these victims, supersede this transparency need. The attorney general, so the colonel did the next step in what Kentucky law requires is you go from your freedom of information or your open records request to the government agency, which is University of Kentucky. Then the government agency responds either with the records or with a letter that says, we're not giving you the records and this is the reason why. Then, if you dispute that, you take that to the Attorney General of the state of Kentucky for an opinion. And the Attorney General gives you an opinion left or right on that, whether it's within our law. And that's free. You don't have to take anybody to court. So if you were yourself rejected on open records request and you didn't think it was right, you could go straight to the Attorney General and ask for that.
Okay, hey, so Andy, it's Chuck.
Hey, Andy. Andy Beshear, our Attorney General, put out his opinion that, in fact, these were open records and that the University of Kentucky at least needed to release them to his office.
So the colonel won.
The colonel won, but the records are not released. Okay?
Oh, I see.
So what this means is that, the university both doesn't want to release these records, and it also doesn't want a precedent that these records would be releasable because EEO started in 1972. And so there have probably been some cases since 1972 that would now be open records cases.
Wow.
And going forward, you know, they want to protect the privacy and confidentiality of the victims, according to their press releases. And so the next...
Could they release the records with the victims redacted? Those names.
That's exactly what the Attorney General said they ought to do under the Open Records Act, because that is what the Open Records Act of our state says, and it's also an analogy to what the Freedom of Information Act, which is the federal version, says too.
Yeah.
Now, in some cases, of course, you'll get some redacted papers from the FBI, and it will have the date on it, and then everything
and
else will be blacked out and redacted, and that's fulfilling the rules. But okay, so structurally in Kentucky, if you don't want to turn over those records, you have to go to court to overturn an attorney general's opinion, okay?
Wow.
Because the attorney general's opinion stands as the standing ruling law on that interpretation until a court might reverse. So
I see.
So you have to have a plaintiff, so they're suing the colonel. All right. So,
because you got to sue somebody.
Or you could just release the records.
Yeah.
So in any case, yes. So there's a lot of controversy about that, and additionally, it's complex. But in an open letter to President Eli Capilouto, the faculty of the School of Journalism and Media stated that we would hope that Dr. Capilouto and the university would apologize to the colonel and respect the rule of law and release the records. Nonetheless, I mean, we're still... background. That's the background, okay?
Right.
And so the colonel is not being sued because Eli Capilouto or the university hates them per se, right? They're being sued because the university believes that these records and the story of victims of sexual assault are
protected.
Now, have they released the name of the professor that has resigned? Is that what they're trying?
No,
they already have.
Yeah.
They have.
Okay.
So my question to you, Keki, is kind of with all of this in mind, where you have a university suing its own student newspaper, does that kind of change the game? Kind of, do you feel like the current state of like journalism education, not only in America but at UK specifically, is kind of having an identity crisis a little bit?
No, I don't think we're having an identity crisis. I think that my faculty colleagues, and I can't speak for them, but I can speak for myself. Journalism is pretty straightforward. We believe in the First Amendment. We believe in openness. And we believe in being a witness for all the people who don't have a printing press or as big a server as us.
Mm.
You know, and we believe in a bit of, you know, in the American version, we like to be, though we are not required to be by law, we like to be unbiased. We like to be ethical. We like to show both sides. And this is something that has come up in discussion of the election, this notion of false equivalencies, mm-hmm. right? So is one side, you know, I don't want to use the wrong hypothetical and use actual cases, because, right? Yeah. But people are...
Right, X News.
Right, yeah. Right. No, when people radio. Are saying, right, if people are saying, you know, well, you know, she killed four guys and he stole, you know, five hot dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly he's in the wrong because he did five.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, right.
That, so there, people are talking about this false equivalency notion that is happening in elements of the press that both adhere to the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, mm-hmm. and which don't. Because we have plenty of outlets these days that have huge followings and mm-hmm. huge impact that aren't following the quote rules that are really not rules or suggestions,
yeah, yeah, right?
For quote good journalism. So we're not in a crisis because of this lawsuit.
Mm.
Is this causing an undue expenditure or weight to the paper? Are they able to afford
the paper? The paper has the paper is led by an amazing person named Chris Poore, and he's been their advisor for a long time. And he's a university employee and a wonderful guy. So he's actually the person who would answer any questions on that. But the paper has reported that the paper has counsel.
Okay.
And so, and I'm not in their budgets or whatever. Another thing about, you know, the other thing about the paper is an independent paper.
Mm.
So you don't have to be a journalism major to work at the paper. There, you can be an art history major, you can be a PE major, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you could still be an investigative reporter.
Wow.
Yeah, you just show up. Our students, coincidentally, are the majority of that paper staff. Mm-hmm. So they maybe coincidentally learned something from the great Dr. Mike Farrell and Professor Al Cross and Richard Lebunsky and Scooby Ryan and all these other people in their classes that led to the winning of the Pacemaker mm-hmm. Pulitzer level prize thing. But but they are independent. We don't, you know, they're not going to get a B minus or a C because they, mm-hmm. you know, they are completely independent. They work really hard.
Yeah, and I think this whole kernel fiasco too, you know,
and they're makers. That's the thing is, you know, I think people don't realize that media are the original makers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you guys are making shows here. You're making information. You're making entertainment. You're making the kind of interaction that happens with music put together.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be a maker. Well, media has been a maker. We make a newspaper, we make a book, we make a magazine, you know, for the longest time. So these students actually have hands-on real deadlines that are connected to real budgets mm-hmm. and real audiences.
It's fascinating. And it's such an interesting case, too, of seeing, you know, the institution of the kernel kind of going against what is being taught by an administration who, you know, is trying to protect itself, but also... You know, I think it's
the best education you can get for the people who are there.
Oh, it truly is. And I think about Wendell Berry. I think about Wendell Berry pulling his papers from the university because of the Wildcat Coal Lodge being built. And basically that you have a university, and I'm an alumni too, so I'm just speaking, this is just my opinion.
You're an alumnus.
Yeah, an alumnus. Sorry, an alumnus. Thank you. You're right. Latin.
Sorry.
Plurals. No, you're right.
You're the language guy, man.
That's true. But I think about, you know, Wendell, you know, pulling his papers because the university took this money to call the, you know, the UK basketball team's dorm the Wildcat Coal Lodge, even though, ironically, it's the only platinum-certified LEED building on campus. So, you know, it's a university that's teaching one thing, but whether it's through its board of trustees or its administration, is kind of doing the opposite. So I think that's a sign of true, you know, on the edge education, that those kind of weird dichotomies are going to exist.
Well, right. I mean, and the thing is, if you have an engaged university, that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's going to happen in every field. I think it's important to say that the Colonel is, you know, the home and the starting base of some of the greatest reporters and writers and editors in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, Pulitzer Prize winners. I think two of the African-American Pulitzer Prize winners, which, you know, there's not that many, are Colonel alums. Huh. Dana Kennedy, formerly of the New York Times, and the late Angelo Henderson, who won when he wrote for the Wall Street Journal. And Guy Mendez and John Wynn Miller and, you know, Bobby Ann Mason and Gurney Norman all wrote for the Colonel.
Eric Reese,
right. Eric Reese was my boss. Eric Reese was my arts editor. So, yeah. But I think, you know, in any university, and it's not just our university, students, if we're doing it right, students run up against these kind of dichotomies where and they're not even dichotomies, they're not even trichotomies, they're all of these different complexities layered upon itself. You know, what about my background, my beliefs, my religion, my learning here, ethics, the city law, the county law, and people have to negotiate that. And I think that's where a complex and valuable education comes. I mean, just me just sawing the top off of your head and putting five facts in there.
Yeah.
I put it right back and solder it on. No, that's not.
Like, wow, a lot of space.
So it's uncomfortable, is what it is.
Well, a lot of it seems to be pushing back against money a lot of the time, because money will attempt to sort of procure truth in a way, and we want create an ad out of the truth,
right? And, okay, and well, you know, back. this is what I will say as a professor who did doctorate work in theory and
please
is that the document for our times, the essay for our times that people need to go back and read is Friedrich Nietzsche's Truth and Lie in an Ultramoral Sense, which talks about the production of truth.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like it's like 30, maybe 25 pages. It'll blow your mind. But when, you know, when the news media says, well, if they're just repeating it, then it becomes true. Well, that's what Nietzsche said.
Yeah.
So, you know, in this particular essay, Truth and Lie in an Ultramoral Sense, is I think that is the document for our times right now.
That's incredible. Well, thank you so much, Khaki, for coming in and letting us know about.
Good to see you.
About
I know.
And come back and see us more often.
I know. And, you know, what didn't we talk about? We didn't talk about my citizen journalist thing.
Oh, yeah. When are you gonna bring the kids? When are you going to bring your class?
Soon. Very soon. We didn't talk about our public service announcements that I'm doing with the College of Pharmacy about naloxone.
Sure. We didn't talk about your class at the Hope Center.
Oh, my class at the Hope Center. I just taught life skills at the Hope Center. Teach the guys, learning to learn. Learning to stay sober. So you start where you start. Do we need to learn how to get a GED? Do you need to learn how to make the steps to, you know, get a welding certification? Do you need to learn how to go through the classes and the case progress that you have to get, visitation back with your kids? Or do you want to, you know, go to BCTC or UK or, you know, what's next for you? So we do that.
That's awesome.
And I bring snacks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm there.
Yeah. Okay, well, Chuck and Ben, it is just absolutely lovely to be here on Bluegrass Bios, and I want to thank you for continuing the show.
Well, thank you, Khaki, and thank you for co-creating it.
Yeah, right.
Shout out to Ben over there. So just in case you're wondering and you're just listening in, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU here at Lexington Community Radio. We were just talking with UK Professor Khaki Urch about journalism in goodness.
Everything. In our contemporary times. Journalism in the age of Twitter.
Yeah, the age of Twitter. Yeah. Wow, there's your dissertation title right there.
Journalism in the age of Trumper.
Ain't that the truth? Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Lexington. This is DJ Kid. Are you sick of corporate radio? Are you sick of hearing the same 12 songs by the same 3 to 4 artists every hour? Then tune into Musicology 101 from 4 to 6 p.m. on Friday nights with me, your host, The Kid, giving you the best of old school R&B and hip hop. You'll be hearing everything from Stevie Wonder to Tupac, and of course, my favorite artist of all time, Prince. So tune in every Friday night from 4 to 6, Musicology 101 with your host, The Kid.
This portion of Lexington Community Radio programming is powered by Sullivan Insurance Agency. Sullivan Insurance has offered insurance for autos, homes, boats, motorcycles, and RVs for over 50 years. A locally owned agency serving the Bluegrass, located at 635 North Broadway in Lexington. They can be reached by phone at 859-233-1637 and on the web at sullivanadvantage.com. Lexington Community Radio thanks Sullivan Insurance for supporting true community radio.
This is Lydia Jacobs, host of Aging Adventures. We keep everyone up to date on what's going on in the senior community in Lexington, conferences available, how to stay healthy. We talk to a wide range of people, professionals, individuals who are paving their own way in the aging world. Aging Adventures with host Lydia Jacobs on Fridays, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock on 93.9 WLXU, a Lexington community radio.
Hey everybody, you're back listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio. I'm Chuck.
I'm Ben.
And with us is esteemed professor, associate professor at UK in the School of Journalism.
And media.
And media, Khaki Urch. Hey, Khaki.
Hi, Chuck. I'm back for more. I said bye, but...
I know. Well, we're very happy...
A little impromptu.
Yeah. Well, we're very happy to have some more time to talk with you, because brilliant mind, a lot of important knowledge and info.
You know, the show is Bluegrass Bios, and we talked a lot about, you know, journalism at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so... You know, I am more than just a journalism professor, and
true.
I'm more than just the kernel controversy, so we can flesh it out here.
Absolutely. So, Khaki, you are the former editor of the Kentucky Inquirer up in Northern Kentucky, my home turf, so that's, I very much likely read your newspaper
You most certainly did.
As a Covingtonian.
Yeah.
Also, you are the assistant managing editor of the Desert Sun newspaper in Palm Springs, California. And now you're currently teaching at the University of Kentucky, but you're also the mother of WRFL 88.1 FM here in Lexington. Classic radio station, more than 20 years of bringing alternative music, viewpoints, news, literally the only alternative left for a long time.
Right, right. And, you know, the thing about WRFL, which stands for Radio Free Lexington, is that it's a grassroots media. You know, you call me the mother of it, and basically what I was a person who had a newspaper column that was well-read, and I wrote about the need for such a station, and it was pretty self-interested because I was just, I loved music, I was absolutely addicted to music, and the only place that a person could find out about new and interesting music in those days before the internet was to physically go to a record store and pay the money for a sight unseen record. And I had moved here from New York, where we had radio stations that were a little more exploratory and sort of educational with playing music. And, you know, we had W, at that time was WBKY, which is now WUKY. It's, you know, one of the most revered and oldest non-commercial radio stations, the first one west of the Alleghenies. And, you know, they were serving the university community very well. They were playing classical music, jazz. They had talk shows. But there weren't that many students involved working there, and we wanted to see if we could, you know, I wrote this article in the Kernel, and you know, about 100 people responded. Editor at the time, the top editor, Liz Karras of the Kentucky Kernel, who is now Liz Pestros, allowed us to put a coupon on the editorial page, which in those days, you know, nowadays we have like, hey, give your opinion, click, you know, whatever. Back then, coupon on the editorial page, like with a yes, I support this, no, whatever. So about 150 people responded. And what happened was there was such a pent-up desire for another form of media, another form of expression in the city, that hundreds of people came together and volunteered and worked really hard and raised the money and made the case and put in an FCC license application, much like, you know, Deborah Hensley, the leader of this group, did later on the LPFM band. So now we have these other two grassroots radio stations, WLXU, which is what we're on now, mm-hmm. and WLXL, El Pulso Latino, which is a Spanish language station.
I'm on 95.7.
Right. And so, and it's amazing what community media and grassroots media can do in terms of expanding the livability of a city.
Mm, that's a beautiful way to put it. You're right. And telling the stories of the community, those local, indigenous, unique stories to that area, I think capturing that history is so vitally important. And,
well, I mean, right, when we started WRFL, it was in the 1980s. The column I wrote was 1985. And we finally got the money raised and the license and the site and all of these different things together. And we went on the air in 1988, and we were, you know, we played Public Enemy when it came out, mm-hmm. right? And that wasn't being played in this.
I mean, they weren't playing Fear of a Black Planet on WKYL.
They were not playing Fear of a Black Planet on, you know. But, you know, we made it as part of our goal was we really wanted to reflect diversity in our staff, in our programming, eclecticism, and also really, as you say, focus on some of the indigenous stuff. We had a music in the 80s. We had a music that was absolutely indigenous and representative of our state and its history in bluegrass music. And it was only being played in Whitesburg on WMMT and in Glasgow on a station there. There was no, because this was well before the movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where all of a sudden bluegrass was cool,
yeah.
right? So, you know, we had the Blue Yodel Radio Time Cafe with Ephraim McDowell, who is the descendant child of Dr. Ephraim McDowell, wow. the Kentuckian who, he's not the child, he's like the great, but he's named after him, the surgeon who is the Ephraim McDowell Medical Center, it's in Danville, right? Is his great, you know, and he went into Eastern Kentucky, and he learned the old-time music, and he became a DJ, and, you know, clawhammer banjo and all that.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, and it's amazing to me that, you know, WRFL and also Lexington Community Radio here, you know, we are the only places where certain genres of music are even being played in Lexington anywhere, and
well, you know,
a lot
funny.
Of local musicians are being...
Should we take a moment? I mean, this is really interesting about me, of course,
yeah.
right? But should we take a moment while we're talking about this community and grassroots media to tell folks, Chuck, I mean, you're one of the managers here, to tell folks about how they can get involved if they want?
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about that, what we are
definitely.
Here?
Definitely. Here at Lexington Community Radio, we're two radio stations. We're located here on 6th Street, in the STEAM Academy High School, which is a dual project between the University of Kentucky and Fayette County Public Schools. You know, we've only been around here for a year and some change, and, you know, we're very much community, by the community, for the community, made entirely up of members. So if you're listening and you want to be a DJ and you have something interesting or something that you don't think is represented on Lexington's airwaves and you want to come on and do a show and talk about it, definitely.
Or just learn more about how to volunteer. There are other volunteer jobs, like if you're shy, but you want to be in this.
Exactly.
Like, Ben, you're kind of shy.
A little bit.
But Ben's in here.
Yeah.
Ben's on the board. Ben's, you know... there are all sorts of activities here in the station that you can be part of. And so how do people figure that out? How do they learn about it and do things?
People can go to our website at lexingtoncommunityradio.org, where there's a volunteer application. And if you go under the volunteer tab, you can apply. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to go on the air.
It doesn't mean you have to show up. It just means you're letting the station know of your interest, and you'll get emails of possibilities, and someone will contact you from the volunteer staff.
Exactly. And you know, we strive here at Lexington Community Radio to just kind of be the cohesive glue for nonprofits and for local folks who want to get information out and educate folks on resources available in the community, just to make our city better and more equal and more well represented of all people.
Well, and the great thing about Lexington Community Radio is, you know, you are a 24/7 radio station, and that means that if you have a tale to tell, storytelling, or if you have a nonprofit that's doing specific things, we can take time on this radio station to have you give a hypothetical. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started this show, it was interview radio. We had folks on, and they talked about different benefits for veterans. Mm-hmm. You know, a veteran listening.
A
veteran listening.
You know,
we had a physician. We had an administrator from VVA there, and it went right down to brass tacks of what someone would know. And it's not the way that broadcast TV, for example, or sometimes, you know, the newspaper has to do a drive-by and say, oh yeah, if you want to help veterans, if you're a veteran and you need help, call this number. I mean, we can have a show where we talk about what sorts of help are available. Are you eligible? Mm-hmm. What will happen there? You know? And just the example you gave with your friend who was just here, is it Katie?
Yeah, Kate Hatfield.
Kate, right? What about modern dance? I'm afraid of modern dance. Yeah, can I be part of it?
Yeah, what's happening in Lexington and Kentucky with modern dance?
Right.
You know,
I mean,
yeah, I agree. It's the most democratic educational format is radio, because you know all you have to do is come show up. That's it. And we'll teach you how to run the board. We'll teach you how to. I always say when people are training that it's easy to show someone how to work a board and work a microphone, but it's hard to train people to have a life of worthwhile experiences and knowledge to be able to share.
Don't let him intimidate you. Your life absolutely is worthwhile.
Oh, it is. It's more of a joke.
Right, it is a joke. So go ahead. What else?
Well, so I guess, Keki, just to kind of transition from this, I know you helped get this station started and WRFL started, and I know you do some other work too, right, in Africa and in Ireland, kind of with media and radio.
Sure, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm lucky to be part of this University of Kentucky School of Journalism and Media and the College of CI, Communication Information, that has had an 8-year relationship with media and nonprofits working in Africa. So I've been to Africa quite a bit.
And where in Africa?
Well, the strongest relationship we have is with the country of Zambia. Mm-hmm. And we also have done work in Botswana and in South Africa. So we had a relationship, and nearly every one of our professors has been to Zambia to be part of this collaboration. We had a long-term relationship with the American International Health Association. Okay, AIHA is based in Washington, D.C., doing work with PEPFAR, which is the federal AIDS group. And so we, and USAID, right? Mm-hmm. So the State Department's information group. And so we would make trips to Africa, and we would train journalists in Zambia, multimedia journalists, but they didn't actually have multimedia. Mm. Broadband is just sort of now coming to Africa. I was sort of stunned myself that Mark Zuckerberg just went to Africa for the first time kind of like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Because as early as 2009, you know, I was teaching the broadband, like actually where the particular cables are going. Mm. I would think that a guy who had Facebook
maybe got a copy of the book.
Right. But so we would go to a place called ZAMCOM, which is Zambia Communications place, and we would train radio folks. We would train print newspapers. Professor Al Cross had a lot to do with things, including a Freedom of the Press Act that they're trying to get into their constitution.
Mm. So right now in Zambia, there's not a Freedom of the Press Act? Kind of, what is the background situation?
Well, right. Okay. Well, Zambia, as African countries go, is one of the best in terms of stability and democracy. It was, you know, it gained independence from Britain. They have a lot of poverty. They have a lot of challenges. But they have a constitutional, you know, sort of government, and they had stability with Kenneth Kondo was their president for many, many years. And then since then, they've had some successive stuff. But there's no such thing really as, you know, really violence or coups, that sort of thing. And there's extraordinary Chinese investment and Indian investment in Zambia. And it's engaged populace. They value their vote. And they value, for that, they value information and learning about what's going on. Much like we do find sort of in Europe, where we will have people on the street will talk about politics, whereas here we don't talk about politics.
We shout about politics.
I mean, I think that CNN shouts about politics and Fox shouts about politics, and we just all stay quiet.
Yeah.
I think that's how it works here. I mean, I'm not
at the bars I go to.
Okay, well, all right.
You got to go on Sunday. You got to go on a Sunday where you see the same people every day, and then you feel a little bit more open, and then you can yell at each other, and then drink, and it's all good.
I saw this great photograph by the photographer named Tread here in town, Larry Joe Treadway. He put it up on his Instagram for. It was an old one, but it was from Chevy Chase Inn, and they had a sign that said "No politics at CCI." So everywhere but CCI, I guess they're under new ownership. But still, So got to meet young journalists, mid-career journalists. I stayed in a lot of different African cities. Went out. Also, was able to take newspapers and education training to Zambian teachers.
Cool.
To teachers in the high schools and the grade schools. My colleague, Professor Mel Coffey, who's our broadcast multimedia professor, is right now on a Fulbright to Zambia to work very closely with. ZNBC, which is ZNBC, which is their national broadcaster. So the difference in Zambia is ZNBC is owned by the government. So there's ZNBC, they get the BBC, and then they have one guy, one white guy, who started a media organization, too, called MUVI, M-U-V-I. But ZNBC is the one that does the news. At least one, maybe two of the newspapers are funded by the government.
Do you think there's a lot of influence on their content because of that?
Well, that's the thing is, as Professor Al Cross was working with the Zambians, and the Zambians came here. They came to Kentucky, many of them. They visited the World Affairs Council of Louisville. Al Cross toured them around the State House in, they saw our open State House. And then they went to... the Attorney General's office and learned about the Open Records Act, which he's enforcing. Yes, there is.
That's amazing. Well, Khaki, I hate to say this, but we're going to have to wrap things up. But thank you so much again for coming and imparting your knowledge. And
it's great to see you.
It's
always great to see you and great to talk with you. And certainly, I think we've covered everything from...
Not even close to everything, but a good section. It's great to see you both. Obviously, I'll be around and... You know, I'm on the board here, on your board, I'm your big supporter.
And thank you so much for all your help in getting the station started, You know, I wouldn't be in Lexington, I wouldn't know anything about radio if it wasn't for your Kernel article getting WRFL started. And
that's true.
You know, just think about
the first time I met you, I raised 10 grand for you.
Yeah, you did, at the 20th anniversary for WRFL. And it was great to see you, and I'm glad you stayed around. And, you know, we've got some amazing things happening.
Well, we've got an amazing city, and this station and the people who are involved in it just make it better all the time, and also make us all aware of the complexity of the greatness.
Well, we would love to have you back, Khaki, because I'm sure the state of media and journalism will continue to change as things go.
But I wanted to say, as promised from about 2 hours ago or so, the ACLU meeting tonight, Friday night, November 18th, is at 167th West Main Street from 5 to 8. And Bluegrass Bios is now on iTunes.
It's up. It's working. Can search for, you can go through the link on the LCR.org website or search the podcast section of iTunes for Bluegrass Bios, and we pop right up.
167 West Main for ACLU.
Yes, tonight at 5. And I believe Frank X. Walker will be there.
Ooh, 5 p.m. Nice with fight. Frank X. Walker?
Yes.
Can't beat that.
Yeah,
right.
Flash meeting, talks, and stuff like that. Now's a good time to get involved in things.
Yeah.
Soon.
Laws aren't worth anything unless you enforce them. It's true. Well, nonetheless, we're going to sign off. Aging Adventures with Lydia Jacobs is up next. Thank you to Kate Hetfield and Kak Yurich for coming in and speaking with us. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio. Bye.